Order of the Senate Committee on Environment and Natural Resources. Today is February 4th, 2015. We have scheduled today a public hearing on Senate Bill 324 and a possible work session on Senate Bill 324. We carried over the work session from Monday for the purposes of hearing testimony from people that had signed up that were here on Monday during the initial public hearing and had signed up to testify. We will be taking testimony from those people that had signed up on Monday to testify. We will not be taking testimony from people that were not here on Monday. So with that, I don't know everybody who is here that was here on Monday or not. I know who signed up, so we'll be we may be hit and miss as we're calling folks to come up. So with that, I'll open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 324, and we'll start off with some testimony from some folks. Larry Jackson, Rob Miller, J.L. Wilson. Are you here? Okay. Well, we'll see. We'll come back to them. How about Jan? Oh, J.L.'s. Are you ready? Okay. You bring anybody else or?
No, solo. They have not materialized.
Okay, they have not materialized. Okay, we will be giving everybody 2 minutes because everybody had 2 minutes last time that had signed up. So
I'll take one.
We'll have plenty of time, but everybody will have two
Make
minutes,
the other
and then
from
if anybody
the
up here wants to ask more questions and have more time, so.
Chair Edwards and members of the committee, for the record, I'm J.L. Wilson, and this the issue I represent the Oregon State Chambers of Commerce, and we're a collection of 66 chambers across the state of Oregon. They are in opposition to Senate Bill 324. I've submitted, for the record, letters from 18 different chambers and communities around the state to that same effect. I think the issue is one of disposable income in communities that have not felt the economic recovery. I don't think anybody is operating under the pretense that the low fuel prices that you see today will last, and so you know a lot of our communities depend on disposable income to keep hotel rooms filled and keep visitors in their shops and to keep guests in their hotel rooms, and so you have a lot of concerned communities around the state. They respectfully request you to let the Clean Fuels Program expire. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you for your testimony. Any questions from members of the committee?
Thank you.
Doesn't look like it. Thank you. Next, I'm going to call Jan Meekums and Mike Freeze. Oh, do we have to stop this and restart?
Hello, members of the committee and Chair Edwards. For the record, my name is Jan Meekums. I'm the state director for NFIB, National Federation of Independent Business. We represent about 7,000 small business members in the state of Oregon, across all of the state and all types of business endeavor. And our members, we've been in discussing this issue for a couple of years. I've been in active discussion over the last couple of weeks, knowing that this bill was coming up for consideration. And our members are very concerned, and they are very opposed to Senate Bill 324 for much of the same reasons that were mentioned by J.L. Wilson and of the chambers. Many of our members are also members of those chambers. And I also would like to mention, after yesterday and listening, or Monday, and listening to the testimony for a couple of hours of research and professionals on this issue, it came impressed upon me this has become the bill of hope. We hope that the LCFS will not increase gas prices. We hope there will be enough low carbon fuels available to meet the requirement. We hope that there will be the infrastructure to distribute and dispense them. We hope there are enough vehicles to use the the fuels if they're available. We hope that during the conversion phase that engines of the current vehicles will not be damaged at great cost to businesses and Oregonians. And we hope that diminished mileage rates don't negate the carbon reduction that we're aiming for, and we hope the credit exchange system is workable. And I think to pass such a pervasive law that has such a potentially dramatic effect on Oregonians, including a possible being left with the tax consequences, that it's too early and there's much that we don't know with the conflicted data that exists. And we are opposed again to Senate Bill 324.
Thank you for your testimony.
Good afternoon, Chair Edwards, Vice Chair Olson, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mike Fries. I'm Vice President of Associated Oregon Industries. We represent roughly 1,500 member businesses and who employ about 200,000 employees across the state. Like you, AOI is very proud of Oregon businesses that value the environment and continue to make investments in improving operational efficiencies that reduce externalities, including carbon. We want to continue to encourage that investment, but not at the expense of Oregon businesses that do not have the capital, financial ability, or competitive market to make the same investments. AOI opposes Senate Bill 324 and the Low Carbon Fuel Standard. However, if this committee is poised to pass the bill, we believe there are a few important issues that deserve more attention to ensure Oregon business concerns are not left behind. For that reason, I appreciate this committee working on amendments to improve the program. Based on the proposed amendments, it is important that the committee strengthen the amending language. While I appreciate our current DEQ director and our current EQC, they're not going to be around forever. And so in order to ensure that the law is applied to what this legislature expects into the future, we need to be very specific about what we mean. So in order to ensure consistent application of the LCFS into the future, we'd like to make the following recommendations. First, the statute should include more detail around what the legislature means by managing and containing the cost of compliance. Currently, the -3 amendment, which I believe we're working from, provides significant discretion to the department without providing fuel consumers any assurances that gas prices won't rise to 19 cents or $1.06. Second, DEQ made a significant change taking out the ILUC, the indirect land use component, and we need to make sure that that doesn't end up back in. And third, DEQ's resources are already very thin, and we want to make sure that this legislature looks at what impact this will have on other DEQ programs based on their budget. So thank you for allowing me to testify.
Thank you for your testimony and for your input. The Oregon Business Association is another business association that is supporting it, and I'm not going to ask you to speculate why they support it and your members don't, but I do want to note that because they can't be here today and they submitted a letter of support. And have you had conversations with them? I mean, I know you guys have different memberships. We all know that, but you know, there is another business viewpoint out there as well. And
I have not had a conversation, Chair Edwards and members of the committee. I have not, this Jan Meekums, I have not had a conversation with them. And they do represent a different type of membership than we have, I would say, for the most part.
I have not had a conversation with OBA. We do have some of the same members, and I can't speculate as to why they decided to support the program.
Okay, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Yeah, Mr. Fries, your organization is pretty large throughout the state. Do you feel that there will be a cost impact caused by the LCFS?
Yes. First, I mean, we can just look at what DEQ rolled out in the rulemaking package, and it identifies three studies, and all of the studies included show an increase in fuel prices.
Thank you. Follow up to Ms. Meekum.
Go ahead.
Do your folks in NFIB feel that there will be a fuel increase, and if it will, how will it impact their business?
Chair Edwards and Senator Olson and members of the committee, Jan Meekums again. Absolutely, that is the prime concern of my members, and I did include two members, Steve Faree and Jack Holt, that did present testimony in writing, and that is their main concern. And energy gas costs are a huge concern to small businesses. They are still weary coming out of the Great Recession, and those that depend on people motoring to their goods and services, or they have fleets, or for instance we have a livestock auctioneer who moves thousands of heads of cattle a year. I asked him how it would impact him. He said it would practically shut us down if fuel costs were raised to the extent that one study showed of $1.18, as much as $1.18 a gallon.
Thank you.
Did that study include a credit type system? My understanding is that study was very limited in the options that were available and the options that were considered in for fuel importers to meet the standards of the program.
Are you referring to the Brookings study, which is
the Boston Consulting Group study?
Boston Consulting. You're right. The Boston.
That's the study that I've come across and I've looked at that has prices raising that much. The studies that I've seen that include all the options on the table are talking about a penny a gallon. So that's I'm struggling here. To figure out, you know, why that would be, why, you know, a dollar a gallon would be a credible number.
May I respond? Again, Chair Edwards and members of the committee, I think that's one of the points I wanted to make after yesterday, is that there was very credible testimony on both sides of the issue and had research on both sides of the issue. And I just, because of the conflict, it seems to me it's irresponsible to make that kind of decision on such an impactful bill until we can get more aligned consensus on research and the professionals that are looking at this issue.
And that's why we're going to call the department up and grill them a little bit at the end of this.
Okay.
Thank you. Or any other further questions? I'm sorry.
I think
Senator Przanski.
One thing that is, I guess, puzzled when I heard that you said one of your constituents basically said that the price of gas could have such a decimating effect on them. I mean, there's so many factors that we in this state have no control over. I mean, right now the gas is under $2.
Yes, it is.
It has been up to $4. That's $2 a gallon difference. And the testimony I heard on Monday from those who have actually experienced putting some of these type of models in place, such as in California, is showing a few pennies a gallon. So I have a real hard time understanding how a few pennies per gallon is going to impact to the point of shutting down businesses where we have such volatility from the foreign market and factors that is going to blow that out of the water to the point. I mean, it seems to me they made it through the Great Recession that you said where the gas pricing was $2 a gallon more. So can you help me with that?
Sure. So Senator Edwards and Senator Przanski and members of the committee, Jan Meekums again with NFIB, I think your comment makes a great deal of sense, and I understand that. I think that where the gas prices are right now is not necessarily where any of us feel they're going to stay. So they are volatile and they can increase. If we are, in fact, talking about a penny per gallon, and that was over a long period of time, and it remains at a penny a gallon, it is negligible. The point is that there are studies that have a wide variation of the effect of this legislation on gas prices. It hasn't been instituted long enough or significant enough or as similar to Oregon's situation for us to know. And if gas prices do go up again, as they've already started to go up just recently, as far as per barrel, if they continue to go up and long term, and this is a long term legislation, This isn't legislation that just goes into effect and then goes away. It's very long term. And so if we look at gas prices going up, we look at the long-term effects of this legislation, if the studies are not accurate, and they do range from a penny to over a dollar, so it's somewhere in that range. It could be nothing. It could be negative. It also could be more than $1.50. We don't know. And so it has the potential to have that kind of adverse effect. I'm not saying absolutely for sure it will, because that's a point we don't know.
Yeah. So just follow up. I mean, I appreciate that. And in your opening comments that you see this as the hope type of legislation, a lot of your comments today have been if and potential. So there's a lot of unknowns and variables, of course. But we do know that certain things are happening, and what we're trying to do is plan for the future for generations to come. And it seems to me that doing nothing is not going to resolve the issues that we know that are out there that's based on carbon. Thank you.
Yeah.
Senator Thompson?
Yeah, I just want to clarify, if my memory doesn't serve me, help me out. Didn't DEQ say 2 days ago they thought the price would increase would be anywhere between like 4 cents and 19? Were those the numbers, or did they say 1 penny? I don't remember them saying 1 penny.
No, they didn't say 1 penny. 35 cents if the cost of a credit is $35.
Okay.
On the market, that equates to about a penny, and that's the range that their credits range from between $20 to $80 in California. They've settled in the $23-$25 range,
right,
for now, and 80 cents. I have data here somewhere, but $80 for the cost of a credit is a couple of cents. 35 is, I mean, it's like, you know, 2-point-something cents, and then 35 is about a penny.
Right, but DEQ said they thought that gas prices could be affected anywhere from
over the course of 10 years. Over the course of 10 years, not right immediately.
Okay.
So,
Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
Doesn't this then allow us to see the incredulity of this bill and the fact that we can't even predict what a credit's going to cost and where it's going to be? The DEQ has stated that the cost will be 4 to 19 or 6 to 19 cents, and that would be predicated, it sounds like, on $200 a credit. We don't have we have no idea where this is going to end up at, and our own agency that reports to us says this is where it's going to be. If we can't believe them, who do we believe?
When we call the DEQ up, I encourage you to
absolutely
press them on that.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Thank you.
That means a green light.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Thank you both.
Thank you.
So I believe a gentleman from Jackson's Auto Care is here, and I'd called him earlier, Larry Jackson or Rob Miller.
Rob's not here yet.
Rob's not here. Okay.
Somebody's
okay.
Here. He's calling in.
It is an incredulity.
Don't ask me, man. I have to call my lifeline.
So on the line is Jason Barbos.
Okay.
Maybe wait for a moment until.
Jason, are you on the line?
I'm here.
Okay, could you hold for a minute? We've got another testifier that's up, and then we'll get to you.
That's great. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Okay, Larry.
Thank you, Chair Edwards, and this is my first time ever doing something like this. My name is Larry Jackson. I'm co-owner of Jackson's Body Shop. We're a third-generation family-owned and operated business here in Salem since 1958. I attended Monday here, and what I heard a lot of uncertainties. I don't knows. I'm not sure. We're not sure. I think. I'm here to tell you what I do know. And that is the cost that will cost my business if any more taxes in any way are put upon us as small businesses or private citizens. Our profit and loss margins are minimal at this time. And we just can't afford any other raises and any kind of taxes. Right now, how this affects us is when we buy parts, dealerships are charging us a fuel surcharge to ship those parts from Portland down to Salem. This last year, one dealership with us spending $65,000 worth of parts that cost us $240 that we could not recoup, or $450 we could not recoup. You might think that's little, but if that's $4,500 in 10 years. If you had 10 shops, that's $45,000 that will not be spent back into our economy here in Salem as retirement plans, additional jobs, and so forth. Also, another way that affects my business particularly is rising parts cost on parts themselves, new, having those shipped from out of state into Oregon and Salem. That would drive parts prices up, which in turn would, with the low used car values, increase the cost of the average estimate on vehicles, and therefore total more vehicles, and those also won't be fixed. So removing that income from our economy here in Salem. So with that, I ask if you have not 100% certainty with this bill, please leave it alone. Don't move forward at all. I appreciate this time to come in front of you and share just a little bit of how this would affect our business and if you pass this bill. It could be detrimental to my business particularly. So.
Thank you for your testimony and your perspective. Do you have any questions?
I do. Thank you, Mr. Jackson. Thank you for coming in, taking the time from your business to come in and talk to us. Do you consider this to be a tax?
I do. I do, yes.
Thank you.
Well, sure. And just for clarity's sake, there's a lot of speculation about whether or not it'll raise, and we just had it. You weren't here, and so you didn't hear the exchange with the panel previously. There have been a number of studies cited, some more credible than others, that have speculated what the cost increase could be. It is not a tax. I understand what you're saying about cost, but there's a complete different legislative process that would happen if it were actually a tax.
I guess if I could interject one.
Please.
Again, not necessarily a tax, but any rise in fuel price, I will be charged for. So whether it's tax or not, if the other day I believe I heard force 1 cent to 19 cents over the next 10 years, if anything's added, this was just one dealership that started charging. If that happened throughout the people I do business with, it could be substantial for all the shops in my trade, or any mechanical shop. I particularly do auto body repair, so we're getting parts from Portland and try to buy our parts within Salem to keep our money local. But so not necessarily a tax, but any increase that anything that would go to rise the price of fuel, I sit here and think as a citizen, this weekend, the sportsman show, the tens of thousands of people that would drive to Portland to participate in something like that, and then ourselves also driving from Salem to Tillamook and the coast and the dollars that's spent, I don't see our economy recovered yet. So anything that would add to that is detrimental as far as I see it.
Thank you.
Mr. Jackson, just clarification, this $450, this is the fuel charge that the dealership was charging you to get the parts delivered to your place of business?
That's correct. I'm charged per invoice on the dollar amount. Again, that's a percentage of the total dollar amount. I cannot recoup that. The insurance companies say that's a cost of doing business. I'm like, fine, okay, then I'll raise my labor rate, which they don't allow me to, because it's a prevailing rate. They're only going to pay X amount of dollars, so that's something I have to eat.
So just for clarification, I think you've answered the question, but so basically under the contracts you have for preparing or to repairing cars, there's some type of prohibition, I guess it is, for those type of fees that you are charged to get the parts to fix the insurer's car cannot be recouped.
I'm under no contract to the insurers. I work for the vehicle owner, and it's simply just stated by the insurers, we don't pay that. So they don't pay it. Just like health insurance or whatever, they only pay X amount of dollars. My materials, they don't want to pay for it. They just say we don't pay it. So too bad. So I either pass it on to you as the consumer,
right,
which I don't like to do because you're the one paying the insurance. My belief is they're supposed to pay it, but most
other subject, another committee.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'll be there.
Go ahead.
Can I just say, you know, Ms. Jackson, thank you. You know, one of the challenges that we face here is that the price of gas, as I think you know, is so elastic. I mean, you know, it's, as was mentioned before, it's gone down nearly $2, you know, over the last half a year. Have your, you know, have you, have, you know, the companies that you're dealing with lowered their rates to you as a result?
Right now they have, what would be the word, they quit charging that at this time. I'm not exactly sure of the actual dollar amount per gallon of when they charge it. It kind of, it went away once before, and then it was back for quite some time, and then they have just probably a month ago quit charging that at this point. So right now we don't have to pay that, but it would, if fuel prices go back up, then it would, I'm sure.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thanks for taking the time away from your business to be here to testify.
Thank you very much. Yeah.
Okay, next we're going to move to the gentleman on the phone. That's Jason Barbos. And for clarification for audience members, Jason was one of the folks that had signed up from over 100 miles away. I was trying to get to everybody. He had a flight that he had to leave. His flight evidently was more important than his testimony. I understand why, and I said, okay, you can call in by phone, since I was really trying to get to everybody that was over 100 miles away last time, but I just wasn't able to get to him. So, Jason, we are limiting everybody to 2 minutes. I will tell you when the red light, when the yellow light is on and when the red light is on. Go ahead.
Well, great. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Jason Barbos, and I'm with the Union of Concerned Scientists, and on behalf of our 11,000 supporters in Oregon, thank you for the opportunity to provide comments on the Clean Fuels Program and SB 324, and I greatly apologize for not being able to be there in person today and appreciate the accommodation to patch me in by phone. Our Oregon members strongly support the Clean Fuels Program as a way for the state to create new industries and jobs from homegrown sources of fuel and diversify fuel supplies to reduce our reliance on price volatile imports. And in addition, they see that as an important step to cleaning the air, improving public health, and reducing the state's global warming pollution. And my organization has been involved deeply in federal and state clean fuels policies for many years, including the California Low Carbon Fuel Standard, which is operating successfully. And we believe that the Clean Fuels Program in Oregon is a smart policy approach to diversifying the state's fuel supply because it is more than a policy to encourage biofuels. It's a policy to encourage the use of all low-carbon fuels, be they biofuels, electricity, propane, or even oil. And it's a policy that provides incentives for continued innovation. And we are convinced that Oregon's in-state resources that can be converted to fuel should make it a magnet for investment in clean fuels, but that investors will need to see a signal from Oregon that the state is making a real commitment to these fuels, or the investors will take their dollars elsewhere. And very briefly, you know, some of the many homegrown resources in Oregon that can be put to use under a clean fuels program include biodiesel made from used cooking oil, which can cut global warming pollution 75% relative to conventional diesel fuel. It includes fast-growing trees like hybrid poplar. It includes methane captured from landfills, wastewater treatment facilities, and dairies. They can replace fossil sources of natural gas used in transportation and cut the life cycle emissions of those vehicles by more than half. And it includes electricity, which is an important low-carbon fuel. My organization's analysis has found that driving an electric vehicle in Oregon produces global warming emissions equivalent to driving a car, a gasoline car, with mileage of rating of 75 miles per gallon. In addition, we find that it is four times cheaper in Oregon to drive an EV than a regular gasoline-powered car. So anticipating that my time is running out, I will just close by saying that by creating a stable...
Sorry. I was interested in writing notes. I missed that your light is up, so...
Well, thank you for the opportunity to speak, and we request your support on this bill.
Okay. Thank you for calling in, Jason, and thank you, committee members, for noting.
Fine, Claude.
Senator Wilson.
Sir, you had mentioned that the California program is working successfully, save for the fact that it's been in litigation for the last 4 years. So what success do you see on it?
Yeah, but thanks. Thank you for the question, Mr. Chairman and Senator. The program has been in litigation, but it has never been stayed from being implemented. And so the program was adopted in 2009, and it has been implemented the last few years, and currently is up and running. And there is currently a surplus of credits that have been generated in the program. So this year there was a 1% reduction requirement. And I believe there was on the order of four times more credits generated than were required to be submitted this year. And as the gentleman from the Air Resources Board, Mr. Katowski, said on Monday's hearing, they have seen at most, you know, around a penny per gallon impact on the price of gasoline. And then just sort of finally, as a result of this policy in California, we've seen billions of dollars in investment in clean fuels and vehicle technology over the last handful of years, all while the state has economy has grown substantially during the same period.
Follow, please.
Yeah, please.
Since the program wasn't working or has been stalled due to litigation, but yet the investment has still been made, how can you contend that the low-carbon fuel standard, which brought in the investment, when in fact they didn't even know if it was going to be held legal or not?
Yes. I apologize for not being clear on that. The program is not stalled. The program is fully up and operational. The most recent lawsuit required the state to sort of cross some T's and dot some I's in relation to the California Environmental Quality Act. But there was the program has not been put on hold and is currently up and running.
I understand that, but follow up, please.
Yeah, please.
If you could answer the question, what I asked was, the investment was made without certainty that the program would be upheld by the courts, but yet still $5 billion, as you said, investment came into the state. Why did it come in if there was no certainty?
That's a good question, and I think that the anticipation from most stakeholders who were following it was that the arguments in litigation against the program was specious and unfounded, and I think largely that has been proven out in court, and so as a result there was, while not certainty, there was confidence that the program would continue.
One other question, please.
Go ahead.
You had mentioned the homegrown possibility to generate fuels such as cooking oil, poplar methane, electricity. As you probably well know, in Oregon, I believe we only have 2,000 electric cars, so it's really not going to drive the market that well. How do you anticipate fuel source reliability with relying on cooking oil or fast-growing poplar or methane, which we don't generate or produce?
Yes, Mr. Chairman and Senator. I get one way to answer that question is to refer you to a study that actually was just released last week that looked at the availability of resources in Oregon and throughout the West Coast. It may have been cited in other testimony, and I apologize if this is redundant, but the International Council on Clean Transportation, to which my colleague, Dr. Jeremy Martin, was an expert reviewer of the report, their conclusions were that there is clean fuel resources from British Columbia through California that can reduce gasoline and diesel consumption in the region by 25% by 2030. And reduce the carbon intensity of the region's fuel supply between 14 and 21% by 2030. So that sort of is one of the most recent major analysis on fuel availability. And then the resources that we are familiar with in Oregon, we believe to be ample as well.
Well, the question I asked was homegrown, and you talked about BC and California, but I don't live there. I live in Oregon, and I'd like to know what the availability of fuel stock in Oregon is, when you anticipate any manufacturing facilities to be built, and with our land use laws, how long do you think it'll take before they come to fruition?
Yes. I don't have a conclusive or exhaustive list of resources, but two numbers that I can provide for you now. One is you mentioned the hybrid popular, which I had raised. And according to the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality, Oregon could produce more than 200 million gallons of fuel from this local resource in Oregon. And then one other example that I'll just have at the tip of my tongue is related to methane from landfills, and that Oregon landfills produce about 2.5 million tons of waste annually that could replace 75 million gallons of diesel fuel with a low-carbon alternative. And then I guess I would just add that electricity, you mentioned that there's only 2,000 electric vehicles on the road in Oregon today, but of course the supply of electricity and the opportunities to provide electricity as a fuel are far greater than that. And one of the nice things about a clean fuel standard is that it actually incentivizes the development of EV infrastructure and the use of EVs. For example, in California, their provision has just been put in place where local utilities are able to generate credits through the program from their customers that fuel up their cars on electricity from the grid, and then provide a rebate back to those customers. And so the low-carbon fuel standard is actually providing extra incentive to utilities and customers to go electric.
I'll go no further. Thank you.
Okay. Senator Denbrough.
Yeah, just briefly, I think the speaker has covered this well, but I just want to remind my good colleague that we're talking about a program that is slated to start slow and ramp up over time and be fully implemented, over more towards the end of the 10-year period. And, the projection there is, although, yes, we only have a couple thousand EV vehicles now, perhaps, I don't know the exact number, that number will certainly grow over time. And we do have a number of industries that are beginning to produce the fuel that we're talking about here, the replacement fuel. I don't know if you've ever been to the area around Morro, the port of Morro. There are a number of companies there that are just, waiting to take off. And that, I think, is, from my perspective, and I know I'm sort of anticipating our comments when we get into work session, but, I think that we are talking about a program that really has the potential to create real economic development opportunities here. We heard about those over the last year during hearings, in this committee, and we know that there are more.
Any other questions for Jason? Okay, thanks, Jason.
Thank you again for the phone accommodation.
You bet. Okay. Next, I want to check in and find out if we have Eric Wolgemuth, Eric, and
Peter. I'm here on behalf of Eric. I'm volunteering also.
We're not. I appreciate your willingness. We're not doing substitutes. I need folks that were here. So.
You can hand it in.
You can certainly submit testimony. Yeah. And Peter Weisberg, is he here? Okay. Next, we'll move to Ian Tollison, Barry Bushu, and Roger Beyer. Okay.
Select off on Monday. No, go ahead, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Roger Beyer. I'm here representing the Oregon Dairy Farmers Association of Oregon. I submitted written testimony, so you should have that through OLA system or whatever system you guys use. And I'll just make a couple points off that testimony. Dairy farmers are opposed to this for a variety of reasons, but two primarily stand out. First and foremost, you've heard a lot about, is the potential cost increase in the price of fuel. Dairy farmers live in the rural parts of the state. There aren't alternative forms of transportation in those areas, and I don't think we're going to see light rail or too many electrical trains or anything like that coming into the dairy farm areas of the state anytime soon. And also, the raising of milk relies on transportation of goods to and from the farms. So raising costs of transportation will greatly impact them. Secondly, is a point you haven't heard before, and it deals with the cost of feed. Dairy farmers' primary source of feed is the same fuel that it could be used to produce the ethanol. And we experienced in the past few years when the low carbon fuel standards nationally first came into place, the spike increase in the price of feed for dairy farmers was astronomical. We can't contribute all of that to the use of food for fuel, but certainly it had an effect on it. There are many dairy farmers that struggled financially with low milk prices and high feed costs at the same time. They have no ability to recoup those costs. Dairy farmers do not set the price of their product. They are price takers. And interestingly enough, the price that consumers pay for milk has almost nothing to do with the price that dairy farmers receive on their farms. The two are completely disconnected. And you can ask me why that is, and I'll have to tell you I have no idea, because I have no idea how milk prices are determined, and if someone can explain that to me, I'd be very beneficial. So anyway, those are the issues I wanted to raise. Happy to answer any questions. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the opportunity.
Thank you, Roger. Any questions for Mr. Byron?
Oh, I thought you were going to be the panel.
Oh, yeah. Thank you. Keep them straight.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ian Tollison, Government Affairs Director for Northwest Food Processors Association. We have 151 food processing companies in Oregon, Washington, Idaho, about 250 production facilities throughout those three states, and we roughly employ about 25,000 Oregonians here in the state. I'll start with our industry. We use a lot of energy. We want to be good players. We have a roadmap to try to reduce our own energy consumption rates. We have a roadmap to try to help reduce energy in our facilities by 25% in 10 years, and we will reach that goal. So we think this is a good goal, and we want to work with you here. But our concern is food. In 2000, over 90% of the corn crop in the United States was used to feed people and livestock. That means less than 5% were used to produce ethanol. In 2013, about 40% of the corn was used to produce ethanol. The competition between fuel and food and feed has a negative effect on food prices, and we are very concerned about this going forward. To help reduce these rising corn prices, the European Union Energy Council reached agreement to cap the amount of biofuels produced from food crops to 7%. The EPA has included a cap on the amount of corn ethanol that can be used to meet the requirements for renewable fuels. You know, we all want a clean environment to live, breathe, and recreate in, but this, I think, has a dramatic effect on food prices. I'll just leave you with a quote here, if I can find it. Here we go. Let's start here. I strongly support requiring a shift to low-carbon advanced biofuel, including biodiesel, cellulosic ethanol, and other revolutionary fuels. But a corn ethanol mandate is simply bad policy. U.S. Senator Dianne Feinstein on the floor of the U.S. Senate. We think this is a good goal. We want to help get there. I don't think the technology is there in time to really reach the goals that we have set right now. Thank you.
Thank you. And I am glad that this is not a corn ethanol mandate.
Me too. So, Mr. Chair, I have to say I can only wait for the day now that the Department of Ag has issued their preliminary rules for production of industrial hemp in this state. We'll have another cellulose to be using in the future for clean air and clean fuels.
Everybody can get high as you make it.
On industrial hemp? You'll get a headache.
Okay. So,
Mr. Chair?
Yes, go ahead.
Mr. Beyer, both actually, because you're both on food production, milk production and food. Concern is, of course, that if we increase the cost of fuel, which we don't know, we speculate as what the number will be, it certainly will impact your transportation needs, which will impact the cost of food. So through the, if you will, food chain of the real world, costs are going to go up across the board because of this action. Do you agree with that or not?
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, yes, I do. You know, there's a lot of debate here about what that price is. I don't know. I'm not a fuel guy, but it'll be something. I think it's important to know that our members have processing plants that do, you know, milk, egg, cheese, juices, frozen vegetables in multiple states. And within these companies, each plant location is really competing against one another. I had a conversation last week with a producer of apple juice, and he was saying that they run 7 production facilities. They could probably go down to 5 if they really had to. Now, is this going to be the end all to that? No, but I think it's just one more additional cost of doing business. We have members in Idaho. Idaho has seen significant investment in food processing, Cliff Bar, Chobani, to name a few, in the last several years. And they've invested millions of dollars and created hundreds of jobs. Right now, there is food processing plants planning on where they want to expand their production facilities. Right now, they have the ability to decide where that investment is going on. When they hear of an additional cost of doing business, they come back and they ask themselves, is this the place where we want to have these sort of investments? And I understand there's an off-ramp. I understand that there's abilities for the legislature to come back in and modify that. But for a business decision to add that into their business plan, it doesn't make business sense. So that's the concern my members have.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Olson. I've already explained to you that the price that a farmer receives for his milk has little to no impact on the price the consumer pays for that same milk. So to say this will increase the price of milk to consumers, I can't tell you if it will or not, but I can tell you this for sure. If it increases the price to produce the milk, the farmer has no ability to raise his prices that he can receive for that product. So he has two choices. He either has to cut costs somewhere else or he has to go out of business. And it's very difficult to cut costs somewhere else in this environment. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions?
I, too, have worked in a commodity industry in my prior professional life, and I experienced similar forces, except when they were applied equally across my industry. So when fuel costs went up, you know, my costs were squeezed, but so were the chip and log suppliers down the street and further north in Oregon and further south in Oregon and up in Washington. And so we were all facing that, and it did pushed the price up that we were able to receive from our for our product. So I have a sensitivity to the commodity issue. You are a taker of prices, but if something does affect prices across the board, which I would contend that, you know, the analysis doesn't look like it's going to be a very large increase at a penny per gallon, and you may choose to not believe it's going to be a penny per gallon, but if that affects everybody equally across the board, then you are able to get more for your product.
Mr. Chair, if I might, what I do know about milk pricing is that milk pricing is done regionally, not state by state. So if the region, I believe the Northwest region includes Washington, Idaho, and possibly Montana, in addition to Oregon. So if the region experienced prices across the board, I think you are correct. But if only one state in that region has price increases, I don't think that would be the case. And Oregon being the smallest dairy state of that region, with the exception of Montana, we are larger than Montana, I'm afraid that we would not have any ability for them to ask for higher prices.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Next, we have Jeff Bissonette and Margaret Puckett.
I've handed some materials that I'll be referring to. Greetings, members of the committee. My name is Margaret Puckett, and I'm a program manager with Shore Power Technologies. We're based in Hillsboro, Oregon. We have 10 employees, and we're the largest provider of electric power for truck stop parking in the nation, with over 1,800 parking spaces. So instead of idling a truck when shut down, truck drivers can plug their cab into electricity and heat or cool their cab, make coffee or a meal, watch TV, or power their refrigerated trailer or reefer, and they avoid burning 11 gallons of diesel per night during the mandatory rest periods. In 2014, I did some research, and we found that trucks that plugged into Shore Power avoided burning over 44,000 gallons of diesel and displaced 500 tons of greenhouse gases. And in Oregon alone, that comes down to 12,000 gallons were displaced or not used, and 135 tons of greenhouse gases were avoided. And truckers themselves saved almost $50,000. And that's from just five truck stops that we have facilities in Oregon. And doing the calculations, even though fuel prices have fallen to half of last year, plugging into Shore Power instead of idling still saves 50% over diesel fuel costs and avoids all of the associated emissions and noise. Now, the largest seller of Shore Power in the nation is the Jubitz truck stop in Portland. I visit there regularly to check on equipment, and I talk to drivers. One told me he drove 25 miles out of his way to stop there because of the plug-in service. Another said, "I'm not a greenie, but a realist. This is a smarter way of doing things." The CEO of a major U.S. fleet that has over 2,000 vehicles says, "Shore Power runs our trucks hotel load and HVAC plus recharges the batteries. It's the perfect complement to our system." On our Facebook page, a husband and driver wrote, it's a great thing for the people who live near the truck stop for reducing noise and fumes. We hope more drivers use this service. It will save you a bunch of dollar signs.
Thank you, Margaret. Jeff.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Jeff Bissonette with the Citizens Utility Board of Oregon, representing residential ratepayer, and I'll be playing myself this afternoon. Sorry, joke from no substitutions.
I'll laugh.
Thanks. I appreciate it, Senator Olson. I'm delivering this testimony on behalf of both Cub and Consumers Union, and Consumers Union has been very involved in California and other parts of the state around clean fuel standards, but we're not able to come either Monday or today. But I'll just say quickly that consumers benefit when they have more choices. The Clean Fuels Program will expand choices for consumers and help lower costs while also reducing greenhouse gases and other air pollutants from gasoline and diesel. The best long-term strategy to hedge transportation bets and lessen uncertainty at the pump is competition and diversification. Introducing competition from cleaner fuels will encourage innovation and exert downward pressure on gasoline prices. Diversifying the fuel supply both decreases demand for oil and gives consumers more transportation fuel choices. And finally, many clean options are available. One of the many ways to comply with the clean fuel standard is by adopting cleaner alternative fuels such as electricity produced from renewable resources, biogas, and even hydrogen. And as we heard from a previous speaker, we've seen in California a range of fuels that are helping to meet and exceed the standard. And it's kind of that last piece that is Cub's direct interest in trying to unite the interests of the energy industry in the development of EVs. And to quickly speak to Senator Olson's point from earlier, although there are only, I believe you said, 2,000 cars, Oregon is about the fourth largest market in the country for EVs and growing rapidly. So with that, I'll conclude my comments and happy to answer questions.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you, Ms. Chair. Just quickly, Ms. Puckett, I'm intrigued by your comment in your written testimony that, where you say that this bill will stimulate further investment in fuels like yours.
Correct.
And but particularly when you say the timing couldn't be better since low fuel prices are freeing up investment dollars for transitioning to alternative fuels like shore power. Could you elaborate on that a little bit?
Sure. The trucking industry has been going green for many years because it just makes solid financial sense to them. In fact, the largest fleets are doing this. They've been adding aerodynamic mods to the trucks and low rolling resistance tires and so forth. And they've also been converting their equipment to be shore power capable. So they are in a situation now where they have increased demand because the economy is doing better and reduced prices. And I follow all the different industry magazines, and they are looking at using those excess dollars to further improve the efficiency of their trucks. And they're doing this with the engine mods, like I said, and a number of other things. And this is really one of the cheapest and easiest. It basically involves a power cord.
Okay. That makes sense. Thank you.
Yeah.
Senator Olson.
Ms. Puckett, thank you very much. And I really applaud you on your marketing technique here by getting diesel trucks to come in and plug in instead of idling. It's awesome. But as my esteemed colleague says, that you stimulate clean fuels like yours. Yours is electricity. There's absolutely no way that a diesel truck is going to be going down the road on an electric motor.
All we're doing is idle reduction. Trucks idle approximately 30% of the time their engine is on. They are sitting still. And in fact, the food producers were saying they have refrigerated vehicles, and those, just the reefer unit alone burns a gallon an hour of diesel sitting still, in addition to if the truck is idling. What we're doing is looking at providing outlets at facilities where the reefers can plug in and they can keep their refrigerated trailer cold, or they can even drop their trailer as sort of a temporary refrigerated storage, as you will. And so it saves them hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of dollars.
And I appreciate that, but the point is you are on electricity. We like electricity.
Sure.
And we actually have passed a bill here that ask trucks not to idle as much. The point I'd like to make, though, is you said fuels like yours, which is electricity. Mm-hmm. A truck driver, you said in your testimony, drove 25 miles out of the way, right, to get to you, so he wouldn't have to burn additional fuel to idle.
That's
right. But
that
cost him 4 gallons of fuel to get to you.
That is correct, actually, and I'm really glad you calculated that out. I didn't want to add all that in my statement because it's a lot of math. This is a trucker at work for Intel, so he drove from Intel to North Portland, and he was there over a 3-day weekend. That's how I know this, because I spoke to him. He would have burned far more fuel.
That's true.
That's true.
But the point is, he did it so he could not have to idle, but he,
right,
had to drive an additional 25 miles to get to you.
Right.
As we drive up the cost of his diesel fuel, he might say, I don't need, or I can't drive there. I need to go straight to my predicted drop-off point, and he wouldn't stop at you, which would, in fact, impact your business.
It actually doesn't work that way, because we've done a lot of polling and research on our customers and how the system is working, and we're actually providing this information, because we have the largest network, to... I'm putting together it now to Argonne National Labs, National Renewable Energy Laboratories, and the Department of Energy Vehicle Technology Office. The way the trucks use the system, the parking, the distance between stops, this still is something worth driving out of their way. It's a new finding of this study that we're happening.
For clarification, I would like clarification on this.
Sure.
So under the Clean Fuels Program, you would be a credit generator.
That's correct.
An investment in your technology could be used to offset deficits by fuel importers to help bring
the
carbon intensity of their fuel portfolio.
We can keep track of the booking hours and down to the second, and so we're able to prove the credits.
At the same time, driving up the cost to your customer by higher fuel costs.
It's very much lower fuel costs.
Their diesel fuel that they put into their rigs to get to your facility will cost them more money by this program.
They will save money, and if you'd like afterwards,
no,
I could
like
show
to
you
I'd
some.
Like to go on to Mr. Bissonnette, yeah, if you don't mind. Thank you very much, and I did like your joke.
Go
it
ahead.
Was kind of, it was
I
kind of
appreciate
good.
That.
Thank you. Will the increased fuel costs hurt your utilities, and what they have to put in the vehicles?
What they have to put in the vehicles?
Yeah, the fuel they have to put in vehicles, that's going to cost them more. Will they have to raise rates to consumers to pay for the additional fuel cost?
Specifically, Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, I think that, you know, we already see volatility in fuel prices, and when you do a rate case, you look at all of the cost of utility. While that might drive up rates to some extent in a, you know, $4 billion revenue requirement, it's probably going to be background noises, and investments in power generation are going to have a much greater impact on rates.
But what we've heard so far, that it'll drive up, now it'll drive up energy costs for electricity, but it'll also drive up food costs.
Mr. Chair, Senator.
Heard prior testimony said it could impact food costs.
Speculated.
Well, we're speculating with this bill, so.
So, Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, again, I'm not a food industry expert, so I can't comment on that. But, again, what I said was while it may have some impact, there's lots of things that have impact. I think that what impacts rates more are the actual cost of generation and the investment in those resources.
Thank you.
That's what I like about this committee, even though Senator Olson and I don't always agree.
Don't
we're
going
to get to the bottom of it. Senator Denbrough.
Yeah, just, you know, going back to the issue of the increase in cost, I mean, you know, I think that perhaps, you know, for the truckers, you know, who use services like yours, they may see there may be a slight increase in the price per gallon. We don't know that. But they're going to be burning far fewer gallons because they're able to take advantage of that. So the overall amount that they're paying for their fuel is going to go down. I think that's how we have to look at this.
Yeah, they're actually using less fuel,
right,
all told.
Okay. Thank you both for being here. Are there any? Oh, excuse me. No, we got one. Okay, we got a couple more panels to get through. My goal is to get through the panels by 4:15. We're not going to make that. So, if you want to have a chance to really dig into the department, Senator Olson.
If these people are here, I'd like to hear from them. They came to testify.
Absolutely. So, Terry Parker, Bill Cluding, and Carl Harbaugh.
I don't believe Carl.
And I apologize if I didn't. Okay. Thank you. Please.
Thank you for the opportunity to testify. My name is Terry Parker. I live in Northeast Portland. History clearly demonstrates higher rates of personal mobility significantly contributes to greater economic productivity, which in turn generates more family wage and better paying jobs. Adding a carbon tax and increasing the costs of motor fuels with a new standard will have a negative impact on jobs and slow the economy. One of the primary factors contributing to the most recent recession was high fuel prices. One of the primary factors driving the recovery are today's low fuel prices. The European economic model that includes heavy anti-mobility taxes is one reason why Europe's per capita GDP lags well behind the U.S. The anti-driving, anti-mobility political mindset in Europe is also a contributing factor as to why European incomes are overall lower than the U.S. The legislature needs to acknowledge that automobiles are the preferred mode of transit by the people of Oregon. They vote by driving cars daily. Yet As a component of attempting to dictate alternative modes, the majority in this year's session seems hell-bent on increasing the cost of living by escalating the price of energy and adding more taxes to gasoline, even though most Oregon incomes are flat and not keeping up with rising expenses. One prediction has the price of gasoline at $5 a gallon by the end of this decade. Hammering drivers with high taxes on motor fuels and then hijacking a portion of the revenues to fund alternative transport or fuels is a social engineering inequity. Public transit on average uses more energy per passenger mile as measured in BTUs and creates more emissions per passenger mile as measured in CO2 than driving a fuel-efficient hybrid car. Any transportation funding package must include transit becoming more financially self-sustainable and bicyclists paying for specialized infrastructure they utilize and lobby for. Since Oregon does not have any oil refineries and is sandwiched between two states that do, let those states deal with the fuel standards and absorb the cost. Let Oregon's most costly and mostly symbolic fuel standard bask and vanish in the sunset. I think you've got another Betsy here by the tail, or Betsy's little sister. It's really going to cost some people.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions of the testimony?
Take the rest of the panel.
Okay. Yes. Keep doing that.
It's okay.
Bill.
Thank you, Chair Edwards. Committee for the Record, Bill Cluding. I'll be speaking on behalf of my members, the Carpenters and Industrial Workers, and also AWPPW. Every session this bill has been looked at and worked on, a lot of questions have popped up. And we've had some good answers, but almost every answer brings up more questions. And here we are again. We have more questions to the answers that we've been getting. But not just here in Oregon. It's everywhere this program has been looked at and installed or tried to install. My members are almost all rural members. Senator Edwards' committee, rural Oregon, we have not recovered from the Great Recession. We have not. We cannot afford any possible chance of an added expense. On the local issue, I've been a board member of the Lucky Mute Water Co-op for over 12 years. We're the second largest in the state. Almost 1,020 meters, three dairies. I sign the checks every month for diesel fuel for our crew to maintain this, and it's that runs close to $3,000 a month. We're a nonprofit group. If we had a certainty that there would not be a price increase, we wouldn't have a problem. But right now, we don't have a certain yes or no answer. What I did was I looked at my car. I was getting 22 miles a gallon, and I was lucky enough I was able to purchase a car. Right now, I'm getting 45 miles to the gallon in a car I can fit in. So maybe that's a route we have to look at. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Bill. Any questions for
I just
panel?
Want to say, yeah. I just want to recognize Terry is a constituent of mine, and I really appreciate your coming down, Terry. And sorry that you couldn't have gotten into the queue on Monday. I know you don't live more than 100 miles, but it
feels, round trip.
But it's a long Thank you.
And in my regard, Mr. Parker, your testimony was very impactful. It shows what real America deals with.
Yeah, thank you. And just for the record, the chart that I gave you, other than the part about Metro in there on the back, came from the book called Gridlock by Randall O'Toole. I believe it was published in 2009 or 2010, and all those figures, for the most part, came from him. And one I would really like to point out is the subsidy between driving and transit, less than a dime versus over 60 cents of a subsidy per passenger mile. So that's going to raise our cost of living, too. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Okay, I had called some folks earlier that did not, that didn't look like they were here. Last call for Rob Miller not here. Eric Wolgemuth and Peter Weisberg, last call. Okay. Carl Harbaugh, sounds like not going to be here. Just making sure. Okay. And I think that's it.
Oh, we done?
We have one more panel. Tom Keeler, Carrie Nissen.
Curler.
And what's that? Curler. Tom Curler, sorry. Carrie Nissen and Jana Gastelum. Okay. I should know that.
Should I go ahead? Okay. Hi, my name's Tom Curler. I'm here today. I'm actually representing several hats. One is a fifth-generation Oregonian. My great-grandfather actually has a picture in the Senate hall. He was Senate president 1913. And one of the things that he did was bring the first minimum wage to the state of Oregon. He was a Republican, by the way.
Not a real American.
Real America. Secondly, I'm a co-founder of Pacific Ethanol, and we we're the largest low-carbon fuel producer on the West Coast. We have a plant in Portomorro. Senator Nimrod was referencing. We have one in Idaho. We have two in California. And the third is I served on the governor's advisory committee with a host of other businesses, including Intel, Daimler, Northwest Natural, the building trades, Portland Trailblazers, lumber interests, the port. And we came to the conclusion unanimously and recommended that the sunset be lifted and that the program get implemented for a full 10 years and that it includes cost containment mechanism, all of which the DEQ has said they would do. And we did it for essentially three reasons. One is it takes carbon out of the transportation. We need that to happen. Second, it does in a way that is performance-based, doesn't pick winners and losers. Third, it creates competition in the marketplace, which is, from a supply and demand standpoint, absolutely a good thing. More supply, less price. And fourth, it's going to spur innovation and jobs in the economy. So it's the right thing to do. Appreciate you taking this up. and I hope you vote it out of the committee. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Edwards and committee members. Thanks so much for the opportunity to talk with you today. My name is Carrie Neeson, and I serve as the Vice President of Air Quality and Advocacy for the American Lung Association of the Mountain Pacific. And our mission is to save lives by improving lung health and preventing lung disease. And we advocate on behalf of healthy air, particularly for Oregonians with lung disease. And we're so pleased to join the more than 150 businesses, consumer groups, labor, environmental groups, and others in supporting this bill. And I circulated lists so you can see all of the members who are in support. Today, each of us in this room will take about 21,000 breaths. For most of us, we never think about those breaths. They're effortless and they're stress-free. This isn't the case for Oregonians suffering from lung disease. In Oregon, nearly 400,000 people have asthma, an additional 180,000 have COPD, or chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. Breathing is something these individuals and their families think about every day. Few things are more frightening than a young child in an emergency room suffering from an asthma attack, struggling to breathe. What can make a 10-year-old cough can literally stop an infant from breathing. My dad has COPD, and if you spend any time with him, you can hear and feel every breath his struggling to catch oxygen. In our state, the majority of our air pollution comes from transportation, nearly 40%, and air pollution affects us all. We don't have a choice in the air we breathe, but we do have a choice of what we put into the air. Cleaner fuels are vital to reduce smog and other air pollutions. We pay for air pollution every day through insurance premiums, medical bills, lost business productivity, and premature deaths. Some say it's too expensive to implement this program. The American Lung Association would say we can't afford not to. Cleaner fuels are essential for our healthy lungs, our public health, and a healthier Oregon.
Thank you. Shannon.
Chair Edwards, members of the committee, my name is Jana Gustam. I'm Program Director at the Oregon Environmental Council. We're here in full support of SB 324. The Clean Fuels Program is an efficient and effective way to reduce carbon pollution. 7 million metric tons over 10 years, that's 37,500 rail cars worth of coal that won't be emitted into the air. It'll spur job growth in our Oregon and the region. It's a win for consumers who want more fuel choice. And it's a very modest and feasible program, really. Since California's program began, they've achieved 3 times the pollution reductions that we'll need by the end of our program. And that's simply because Oregon's a smaller market. But this is very doable. All the people who are worried about speculation or not, just look at the program that's already on the ground. California is proving out that this is very doable and achievable. Sonia Yeh said it actually only costs a third of a penny thus far, and they're exceeding their standard by 4 times already. Oregonians want more choices. There are a lot of supporters and many who couldn't have been here today, but I just want to mention a few. Hawthorne Auto, a small business and part of the Main Street Business Alliance. There are small business representatives throughout the state. And Willamette Valley Transport, a small business that runs 14 vehicles on propane, saving $2,500 a year and using those savings to expand their business. A recent poll showed that a large majority of Oregonians support the program, and during the DEQ public comment period, 75% of in-person testimony and over 75% of written comments were also supportive of the program. Oil is too costly to depend on in the long term. I think that we've all recognized that, and that the best hedge against oil prices really is diversification. There has been some claims, I think, by oil industry representatives that they speak on behalf of low-income folks. But the truth is, what really hurts people is a single monopoly fuel that you can't control. How's a family supposed to plan around a $1 price swing in just a year? What we need is affordable, widely available options that are more than just oil. Low-income folks also suffer the greatest health impacts, as Carrie mentioned. The oil industry is a proponent of a do-nothing status quo, but we should ask them, what are they doing to attract clean energy investment and create family wage-supporting jobs in Oregon? How are they protecting Oregonians against inevitable future oil price spikes? And how are they guaranteeing that 7 million metric tons of pollution won't enter our air over the next decade? We've had a lot of process around this. It's been 6 years since this has been authorized, 16 work sessions through DEQ, multiple hearings, including two in the last 3 months. We can't afford further delay on this. Our climate can't afford it, and our economy can't afford it. I urge you to support lifting the sunset on the Clean Fuels Program, and we'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you.
Senator Thompson first.
Okay, Senator Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Let's see, is it Tom or?
Yes, it is.
Okay, on the Clean Fuels Advisory Committee, I have Neil on there.
Correct. He's the CEO. I report to him.
So, you attended the meeting?
I did.
Okay. Just because of all the controversy that's been in the paper lately over clean fuels and who's profited and maybe profited or whatever, just a little conspiracy theory today. I had one of my interns first day show up from Portland State today, and we gave him the we just said to go through the list of who's on the advisory committee. And find some background information. And it seems like everybody that is on that committee, except maybe Justin Zuhler, who's a member of the Portland Trailblazer organization, seems like everybody that's on this committee could benefit from this clean fuels program. So I think there's a lot of mistrust out there with what's happened in the papers lately over the clean fuel program. Could you give me an example? I'm glad you came today because it's the only member we have on the committee that's been in front of us. How will your company benefit if we do this clean fuels program?
Well, I'm glad you said that it seems like everybody would benefit. I think everybody in the state of Oregon is going to benefit from this program.
But how would your company?
Our company specifically will actually be investing. If this program goes through, we will be making investments in the state of Oregon, which otherwise we wouldn't do. And through those investments, we will be lowering our carbon, which will be taking carbon out of the transportation fuel and being able to sell into the market. So it's that simple.
So, will your company profit by producing something, or are you looking at the credit idea and getting the credits? How do you look at this?
Well, from a business standpoint, yeah. There will be an incentive to lower our carbon, which is a good thing. It will entice us to invest, which we've done in California, and because of that, we hope to sell more fuel.
What about the credit side of it?
The others will be receiving credit by buying our fuel, but we don't receive the credit.
Thanks.
Yeah.
Potentially a generator.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
Let's see here. So, Mr. Kohler, is it Kohler? I got that right because we left an R off your name someplace in there. Your contention is that your company will not buy credits. You'll be selling fuel.
Correct.
And what type of fuel do you sell?
Primarily ethanol, but we have the capability of producing biodiesel as well.
Do you produce ethanol now?
Yes, we do.
And where at, please?
In the Port of Morrow.
Oh, do you? And are you Z-Chem?
No, we're Pacific Ethanol.
The Pacific Ethanol,
yeah.
Okay.
So, and also in Idaho and also in
California.
How many
gallons do you produce, sir?
40 million in the state of Oregon.
And how will you change your feedstock to get lower ethanol, lower carbon in your ethanol? Or will you?
We absolutely will. But the first thing we'll do is we'll lower the carbon of our current feedstock, probably by investing in a bio digester, and so reducing the amount of fossil fuel inputs into our plant will take probably somewhere between 15 and 20 CI points off of our score.
All right, thank you.
Yeah.
Ms. Gastelum, did I get that right? You said that for low-income people there would be affordable options for them. basically the only option they have is to buy a vehicle that can use the new fuels. How do you think that that's going to impact their economic standing if they have to revert from a vehicle they're used to using to a car that will handle the new lower? I know we're at E10. Don't anybody go after me about the E10. We're on the E10. These cars that they drive typically are low mileage vehicles that are pretty cheap, so they can get into. They're going to have to buy better vehicles to maintain the new fuel sources we're looking at. How can this impact their or help them if they have to make these expensive purchases?
Chair Edwards, members of the committee, this doesn't regulate individual consumers at all. No one actually has to purchase a new car at all. There's no change that would be needed. What we're saying is that when we only rely on oil, we're only held hostage to being to the sort of dynamics of global oil markets. And when we diversify, we have more low carbon and more affordable options available. What we need is that diversification and that competition, and that's what helps consumers in the long run.
Follow up. I appreciate that, but you know, we're at E10, so we're always going to have oil in the mix. There's going to be always be gasoline, right? And we're going to have different kinds of ethanol with lower ethanol content. Is that correct? And we're going to look at alternative fuel sources, like maybe a hydrogen fuel cell, maybe propane. Do you think that the low-income people could get into these new electric cars or hydrogen fuel cell cars, propane, natural gas cars? Do you think that they would have the ability to make that purchase?
Chair Edwards, members of the committee, there are actually examples in California where this program has already been up and running of really innovative electric vehicle car sharing options in low-income neighborhoods. And that's in part because electric vehicles have some of the lowest cost of ownership and the fuel cost savings are extraordinary. So there are ways to make these available for low-income folks throughout the country.
And the only thing I would add also is when you increase the supply of alternative fuels, all of which, it's a basket full of fuels that you just rattled off, all of which are competitive or cheaper than gasoline. When you increase the supply of those fuels into the market, it's going to lower the price of gasoline to the whole, to every consumer. So consumers are going to be the beneficiary of this.
In a real market where there is a market where you can actually use propane as a fuel or methane or natural gas as a fuel, but we don't have that market. We have a very small chunk of that market, but we have 3.3 million cars in Oregon. I defy you to tell me exactly how many run on propane or ethane or methanol. Those kind of fuels are wonderful, and they will drive the market price down, but we don't have the market, and in 10 years we're not going to get the market.
Well, we'll have more of a market than we do today, sir, and
that's true.
That's one of the beneficiaries of this law. Proposal.
Other members of the committee have questions? Okay. Same then. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, thank you.
So, is there anybody else that signed up on Monday, that is here to testify that didn't get to testify on Monday already and wasn't called today, like I just missed you on the list or something? Just making sure. Okay. I've had a lot of questions. I want to call the department back up. I have a number of questions from the first hearing and today. So if the department could please come and answer some of our questions.
Do they need a blindfold, Mr. Chair?
Well, I do want you to know we're wearing our low-carbon Kevlar vest.
I love it. Great job.
I'm not sure it's going to be enough, though.
Okay. So I have a number of questions, and so I will just get it started, and then if other people have questions, please feel free to chime in. But okay, there was a lot of discussion on day one about process and stakeholder engagement in the process, and so. I want you to speak a little bit about how stakeholders were involved in the development of the program that we have before us.
So, Chair Edwards, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Palmer Mason. I'm the legislative coordinator for the Department of Environmental Quality. I have with me here Corey Ann Wynn. She's an air quality planner at the department, and she actually oversees the Clean Fuels Program. I'm going to let Corey answer that question for you, Senator.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Corey Unwin, and I work for DEQ. So, Chair Edwards, to summarize the stakeholder process that DEQ has undertaken for this rule package, we began back in 2010 with advisory committees. We've had three advisory committees, 60 different experts that have served on those advisory committees to look at how the program is designed and what the potential fiscal and economic impacts of the program are. We've had several rulemaking. And in this last rulemaking alone, there's over 700 comments that were submitted on the record for DEQ and the commission to consider as part of the rulemaking. And all of that information, ongoing workshops and meetings with stakeholders and legislators, local governments, fuel users, what have you, have all kind of helped us inform what the rule is today.
And if I may add, Chair Edwards, just to give you some metrics about that, some actual numbers, the original advisory committee that met between November of 2009 and January of 2011 had 29 members and met 13 times. Then we had another advisory committee, committee met, is the right number here? Yeah. Okay, this is the fiscal committee, yeah. So they met, and fiscal committee met and considered the fiscal impact of the Phase 2 rule, and then the Phase 2 rule advisory committee met three times and had 20 members representing a broad range of interest. And that doesn't account for once we had a draft rule, a proposed rule, there was an opportunity for stakeholders to provide input at that time, and there were a couple of sessions, public workshops in front of our Environmental Quality Commission before they adopted the final rule.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman?
Go ahead. If it's to this process.
To the committee membership that I talked about earlier, my list shows only 15, so I don't know which list that was. It's the newest list, I think.
Chair Edwards.
My comments were just to this list.
And I understand that, Senator Thompson. Just to be clear, that was an advisory committee that the governor's office put together.
Okay.
That was not a DEQ advisory committee. We participated in that process, but the numbers I was giving were to our separate stakeholder process.
Okay. My second question, and I'm going to run through my questions, and then because they may be covered.
Think Senator Olson has any questions?
I'm sure he does. We heard testimony about the concern of fuel availability, I understand why people would be concerned about that. Do you have data that would assert that there will be fuel availability that in order to meet the requirements we can meet the requirements of the bill, still have fuel availability? That's not going to spike prices.
So Chair Edwards, so we feel confident that there's going to be enough fuels for Oregon to meet its standard. In June of 2014, we did commission a study specifically to look at 10% reduction in Oregon, and that study concluded that there are sufficient amounts of fuels to be able to meet that standard. In addition to that, there is also a recent study that was published that addressed regional fuels, so not just Oregon, but Oregon, Washington, California, British Columbia. And that study shows that there is sufficient amount of lower carbon fuels to supply the entire region through 2030. And both of those studies did examine multiple different scenarios of different kinds of forecasts of fuel availability. And under all of those scenarios, both of those conditions were met.
Okay. Thank you. So energy cost is very important for low-income Oregonians, especially. And it's also very important for businesses and economic development. Could you explain how this program could help provide consumers with access to lower cost energy even?
Sure. So, Chair Edwards, so I think I'd like to start by just reiterating that you've heard a lot of other testimony as well, saying that all of the alternative lower carbon fuels that are available today are all cheaper, the lower price than the gasoline and diesel that it replaces. We're talking about the biofuels as well as electricity and natural gas and propane. The estimate that has been used several times from the DEQ staff report for the rulemaking that cites the potential price impact of 4 to 19 cents. You know, again, to reiterate and put it in context, that's in the 10th year of the program when a full 10% would be realized. That's a potential range that was estimated by looking at the studies that were currently done in the states of Washington and California. And again, those were studies that did not even take into consider any kind of cost containment mechanism. So again, those are on the high end of a range of possibilities of what could happen. And again, with the Dash 3 amendment language that we're talking about as far as containing costs, I think this is where you can get into the discussion of, you know, so if there was a mechanism that could manage the cost of the credit, then that would be protective for being able to mitigate, you know, higher price increases. So as, you know, so for example, you know, the $35 credit price that we're talking about, that translates into a penny a gallon over a 10-year period. You could, you know, there are other, you could also say that for like, if the price of the credit was $100 a ton, then that would translate into 4 cents per gallon over the entire year of the program. But, you know, again, the credit price in California right now, as reported by California Resources Board and UC Davis, is about $26 per credit. So,
and if I might add, Chair Edwards, the mechanism or what's proposed in the Dash 3 and in the Dash 6 amendments, the additional authority to the Environmental Quality Commission to manage costs, isn't the only tool in the toolbox. One of the things that's retained in both of those amendments and was in the original 09 law was the authority for the Environmental Quality Commission and DEQ to respond to price shortages or supply disruptions. And so that authority is retained. And actually what's unique about that one is that is a forward-looking price mechanism. So it works like this. If we see, looking a year out, that there is a new war in Jordan and it's going to affect fuel supplies, or there's a pipeline that burst somewhere, or you know, something like that, then we can suspend the program under that authority. And we keep looking, you know, every month we're looking further out a year. So it tries to anticipate problems before they actually result in a price increase.
Okay. We also had testimony, and I want to clarify for everybody that doesn't know the difference between the Dash 6s and the Dash 3s. The Dash 6s simply add the railroad exemption that is in rule, codifies it in statute. Everything else about the amendment is the same as the Dash 3s. I am concerned that trucks may not be able to receive warranties, and I've been a little bit concerned. I've heard a lot of discussion about warranties, and I'd like some sort of explanation about how that works today and your response to that.
Chair Edwards, to begin, you know, so the renewable fuel standards for the state of Oregon is what mandates the E10 and the B5 blends in Oregon today. The Clean Fuels Program will not change what that program is. So that is a limit that is placed on by the renewable fuel standards. What the Clean Fuels Program does is then just change, you know, in sense lower carbon ethanol or biodiesel. It does not require any additional, you know, changes to higher blending. You know, it's possible that people that can or want to do higher blends or switch to alternative fuel vehicles or whatnot, this program does provide options for that, but it does not require any additional blending above E10 or B5.
Okay. Thank you. And is it related to that particular question?
Yeah, I think
so. Go ahead.
Okay, thanks. What I've heard in California is like with the semi trucks, their program, maybe I'm confused, but they had to buy brand new semis to meet these new qualifications with emissions. So the engines had to fit. So that's why all of a sudden we hear in the Oregonian that a lot of trucks are being sold in other states, you know, used trucks, because they don't meet that new emission standard. And at first they were exempt, and now they're not, and they're having to spend all this money to replace their fleets. Is that built into this system?
Chair Edwards.
And now I hear farmers down there are going to have to start buying all new tractors because their engines don't meet those new standards. Is that going to happen here in a couple of years too?
Yeah, Chair Edwards, Senator Thompson.
Yeah, is that a different
program? The short answer is no. And the reason for that is, I think what you're referring to is California has very extensive regulations, air quality regulations, around diesel engines. And they have a phased schedule that requires older diesel engines to be removed from use and either retrofitted or removed from use over a period of time. And I'm guessing what you are referring to is there was a requirement for long distance haul trucks to phase into newer engines, which are certified by the EPA to be cleaner and that type of thing. It's easy to understand why one would think there's a connection. The Clean Fuels Program, though, is only about transportation fuels and what gets sold in Oregon. And the point of the program is to see that we have cleaner, lower carbon fuels sold into Oregon, meeting that 10% reduction over a 10-year period. So, you know, on the one hand, our program, the Clean Fuels Program, is only focused on the fuels, as opposed to what I think you're talking about is the actual air quality regulations in California.
Okay. Thank you.
My final question for the department at this point, and maybe I'll think of some others, but some folks that I've talked with, not in this committee room, but have just, you know, grabbed me privately and said, hey, you know, we're concerned about how onerous the reporting requirements could be. So I'm wondering, how long have fuel importers been reporting to DEQ under the program? And are the same reporting requirements in place in California?
Yeah, so, Chair Edwards, so fuel importers for Oregon have been reporting information to DEQ since 2013. It's a web-based tool that they have to go in quarterly and submit information about the fuels that they import into Oregon. This is the identical tool that is used in California for implementation of their program. They have been operating it since 2010.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. Senator Olson, yeah.
Yes,
thank
you.
I'm assuming that you have a question. I would be disappointed if you didn't.
I have a few. Thank you, and once again, thank you for the telephone conference we had the other day. I've got a quote here that says, in some cases, B.C. government acknowledged in 2009, British Columbia acknowledged in 2009, indirect land use changes can increase the carbon intensity of biofuels to the point where the biofuels have greater greenhouse gas impact than the fuel they replace. Did you use indirect land use in your calculations?
Chair Edwards, Senator Olson. The indirect land use change was not incorporated into this our rulemaking. That was a decision that department made because we wanted to use. There was a recommendation from our original advisory committee that we use sound science as the basis for how we calculate carbon emissions. The science for assessing the value for the indirect land use change has been evolving over the years of this policy. And at one point that there was values that put, especially corn ethanol made, powered by coal, you know, specifically is what some of the numbers indicated, that it might be higher than the petroleum that it replaced. But the science has gotten much more accurate since then, and the current numbers that are proposed in California do not show that it's more higher carbon than the gasoline it replaces.
So, if I may,
go ahead.
Thank you, Senator Olson. If I can add, because I know this is an issue that has come up quite a bit, I want to be very clear on the record for the committee. The department is committed to including indirect land use in the values that are used for the program. But it's as Corey said, the important point is to make sure that we have scientifically sound values. And we didn't think that we were at that point, or even what was happening in California had quite reached that point. We believe we're California's poised and ready to give numbers that we can look at. And we could do that in, assuming the sunset's lifted for this program and we go into rulemaking, we could do that and look at that. But we have committed to including that in order to completely account for the greenhouse gas emissions that you're referring to, Senator. We need to include that factor, and we have committed to doing that.
Well, let me ask a question then. You follow up, please. Yep. Thank you. Let me ask a question then. We knew this program came into effect in 2007. Is that correct? Or 2009, I'm sorry, 2009, 2 years before I got here. We knew this program was going to be in effect. Did we hire either of our universities, which are great universities, to work on the sound science that we need to put this program into effect accurately? Or did we just rely on what California did? We said we were going to follow their model, but we didn't follow their model because they used indirect land use and you didn't. So the model was thrown out the window, but we picked out what we needed to make work what we wanted. And then you came up with 6 to 19 cents on your first report, and now we're down to a penny. So where is our sound science? Where is it? What if we're going to add this land use increment later? What happens if we find out that it impacts the carbon intensity of the products we're now using in the near future?
Yeah. So would it be frozen forever? I mean, or would they? Is that what you're?
I don't know. Of? I don't know. Would you change if the land use component adds, in this case, in this report I have, it adds 30%. To put Midwest ETHC 001 from 69.4 to 99.4, how is that going to impact what we're doing?
So, Chair Edwards, Senator Olson, so I would say that indirect land use change from the get-go, from the beginning of this program, has been discussed extensively with our advisory committee. There are several very knowledgeable people in indirect land use change that have been involved in our advisory committee process.
May I interrupt? Could you send me those names? Are these doctorates? Are these scientists? Or are these just stakeholders?
Stakeholders within the state of Oregon that are knowledgeable about the topic. They follow the science that has been done by the California Air Resources Board extensively. And so we've been, and in addition to the fact that the agency, that DEQ, has worked with the California Air Resources Board on an ongoing basis to follow the science that they have been doing. And again, as I want to repeat, you know, this is better information that's informing the new updated values. And there is a lot more certainty, a lot more, I would say, agreement. You know, I don't think it's not a consensus based number, because the information feeding into those numbers will always get better and better and better. And so as the process has gone along, there is more agreement about what those values are. And so, you know, you cite, you know, adding additional 30% on to the direct emissions of corn ethanol. That number has decreased to about 15%. And again, I think there is general agreement of what those numbers are. California is in the process of presenting those for rulemaking to their board. They will go to the board later this year for adoption. And then again, you know, there might be some change from what's currently proposed to what's adopted. But I think, again, what the adoption from the California does is provide more certainty to what that value is.
And if I can add, part of the policy that's behind the Clean Fuels Program is to create an incentive to have additional investment in these alternative fuels. And you heard Mr. Curler talk about this, how companies that are producing these fuels, some of which are in Oregon today, do start now have incentive to start looking at their production methods, the way that they generate those fuels, and they can look harder. That credit becomes a valuable commodity for which they can monetize their work and get further incentives to reduce their overall carbon footprint and lower the carbon intensity. So that's part of the market transformation that happens with the Clean Fuels Program.
But that market transformation, follow up, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
And do you have a, well, go ahead.
Yes.
Go ahead.
Yes. The problem with the market transformation, as we see here in our revenue impact statement, revenues to the highway fund might be impacted negatively. The highway fund, the fund that we rely on to build our roads and build our bridges, they can't even predict. It's indeterminate. They can't even predict because you cannot give us a specific number as what it's going to cost Oregonians, because the market that you are creating is a mandated monopoly, so people can sell an instrument, a paper, a document, with no regard to what's behind it. Ah, my fuel's cheaper. I'm going to sell this to you because you're have too much carbon. Now, let me ask you a question directly. Do we not require, or will we not have to require, that we sell many credits early to balance out the fact that we won't meet our requirements late down the road? And this is proven in every one of these studies? Is that correct?
So, Chair Edwards, Senator Olson, that is an important feature of the Clean Fuels Program, that the importers have the ability to bank credits for future compliance. And as I think you've heard from California, and certainly it's been our experience in looking at the California program, there has been a high number of credits that have been generated, even though the actual standard they have to meet is much lower, because they're trying to, in California, it's both importers and producers are positioning themselves for future compliance. I think you're right. Most of those studies, and Corey can chime in, do require that the importers have the ability to bank, and so that's why that's an important feature of the program. But if I can talk a minute about credits, it is more than just a piece of paper. In order to qualify for the credits, you actually have to document to the department that there's an actual amount of transportation fuel that wouldn't have been available without an investment in an alternative fuel. Or producers do have the option of blending as another way to generate credits. But it's more than just a paper document, that we actually have to see and get documentation that there's an actual amount of transportation fuel that wasn't going to be available otherwise, and that gets recorded in our system. We don't set the price. We don't nominate buyers and sellers, but it does get accounted for, and we keep track of that. So,
Follow up?
And the critical key there is you don't set the price, so it's a market demand price. So there is absolutely no way today, tomorrow or next week, that you can tell us what it's going to cost us per gallon of an increased cost of a hidden tax.
So, Senator Edwards, Senator Olson, I agree that I don't think we can give you absolute crystal clear, looking into a crystal ball, certainty. That's a fair statement. I think we have looked at the evidence out there, looked at it very carefully, with an eye towards what are reasonable assumptions, and I think the estimate we gave you, the 4 to 19 cents a gallon, is an estimate that we feel very confident in. But there is one important caveat that Corey talked about. That is an estimate that was done without the additional authority that is being contemplated in the Dash 6 Amendment to do cost containment. And so we take the whole notion of potential fuel and prices going up very seriously, and that's why we're asking for that additional authority and keeping the tools that we already have that we think can work well to manage that. It doesn't do the program well to have high fuel costs, high fuel prices. That's not good for Oregon. It's not good for DEQ. It's not good for our economy. So that's why we've asked for this authority to try to manage this, and we think we have the tools, and with the additional authority, we will have the tools to do that.
Okay. One last question.
This is a question.
Okay.
Predicated on your 6 to 19 cents, if we drop to 4 cents additional, that's going to cost Oregonians $60 million a year or $120 million a biennium. That's significant dollars out of the economy hurting working families and not allowing us to repair roads as we should, because this money is not going to go to roads. I think we need to postpone this so we get true, accurate scientific knowledge, accurate data. So instead of speculation, we've done this before historically in Oregon. We've wasted money on many projects.
That's because a question, Senator.
It is.
You promised that. I've always taken you to be a man of your word.
And the question
we're on the edge of our seats.
To me, it was just implied that this is a question. But man, you know how to stomp.
Wait until we go to work session.
Yeah. If we go at 4 cents, that'll be $60 or $120 million a biennium.
Not here.
This is not here.
Where are
we supposed
to be?
Yeah. Wrong
place.
Yeah, that must
be going to
join us.
Please tell them I'm coming.
Is that a correct statement, Palmer?
So, yeah. Chair Edwards, Senator Olson, I'll be honest with you, and maybe Corey can help me here.
Well, pardon me. Have you been dishonest in the past?
Never.
Okay, I know that.
No.
Let's stop it. Let's stop, man.
That's okay.
Yeah.
That's okay.
Yeah. I'll be honest. I don't know where the $60 million number is coming from. I'm not. Are you saying
one and a half billion gallons times 4 cents is $60 million?
All right.
That's what we do. That's what we sell in our state.
All right. All right. Thank you. I didn't have the benefit of the calculation. There is a risk that we could see that happen. We are confident, though, and that we are going to have tools in place to prevent that. And even if that is going to happen, that comes at the end of the program. 4 cents in 10 years in the future is not 4 cents today. I'm not trying to run away from the fact that that is a price increase and that affects businesses and Oregonians. I well understand that. But again, we feel like we're going to have the mechanisms and the tools to address that.
Thank you.
Senator Thompson?
I just have one quick question for DQ. What is the fiscal on this? Do you know how many employees you're going to have to run this program? Do you have a fiscal amount that you've worked on?
Chair Edwards, Senator Thompson, there is a fiscal. And I can tell you that fiscal states that there's no actual fiscal impact associated with Senate Bill 324-3 or the -6 amendments. And the reason for that is we are going to be taking vacancies in the department and shifting those to work on this program. Corey's been working on the program for the last several years. She will continue to work on the program in the future, so that's one FTE. We're moving a vacant manager position from our Western Regional office and making that position available to work on the program, and that's being done because we're reconsolidating the responsibilities of the other air quality managers in that office. And then there is an IT data person, a half position that Corey can speak to more than I can.
Follow up?
Yeah, so follow up.
Are there any hidden fees in this bill at all that nobody's seen yet?
No, sir.
Are there anticipated fees for this program?
No, sir. Let me be very clear about that. There are no fees. There's no revenue going to DEQ. There is a cost of compliance to the regulated parties for having to set up reporting systems and reporting data to DEQ. So I don't want to say it doesn't cost them anything. But for DEQ, there's no revenue associated with the program.
Thank you both for enduring the drubbing. I appreciate you being here because these are serious matters and we want answers. So thank you. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 324, and I'm going to open up a work session on Senate Bill 324. I will be... There have been a number of amendments submitted. We have been discussing the -6s. I explained earlier what the difference is between the -3s and the -6s. I'd entertain a motion on the -6s. Senator Dembro?
Chair Edwards, I move to adopt the -6 amendments dated February 3rd, 2015.
Senator Dembro moves to adopt the -6 amendments dated February 3rd, 2015. Let's have some discussion. Is there any discussion?
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, it's wonderful that we can look to the future and say we need to reduce our carbon. It's scary when we look to the future and we have no idea what it's going to cost Oregonians. Oregon is in a very interesting place. We're 33rd in poverty, 33rd in per capita income, 46th in unemployment, and we are the number 5 state for people on food stamps. And we sit here in the dais asking Oregonians to pay more for a fuel, the clean air. I'll admit that I'm a skeptic to the consequences of CO2. But if we would have had definitive science to prove that this program, AR1, will work at a cost that we actually know, I could consider supporting it. When the department or the LFO comes out and gives us their revenue impact statement, and they said the general idea assumes that the introduction of the clean fuel requirements can be a significant incentive for production of alternative fuels, which might increase investment, employment, and income with all the associated tax revenue. It could, on the other hand, expand the reliance on out-of-state imports of fuel blends, consequently reducing investments, reducing employment, and income, and the associated tax revenues. Since we are that into this program and our own Department of Legislative Revenue has tremendous concerns, I suggest we postpone this so that we can get those definitive answers and then move this program forward.
Thank you, Senator. Are there any other discussions on adoption of the Dash 6 amendments? If there's no further discussion, could you call the roll?
Senator Denbrough?
Aye.
Senator Pozanski?
Aye.
Senator Thompson?
No.
Vice Chair Olson?
No.
Chair Edwards?
Chair votes yes. The amendment is adopted.
Mr. Chair, I move that Senate Bill 324 be reported out without recommendation and the bill be referred to the Finance and Revenue Committee.
Second.
The Senator Olson has moved. Thank you for the Senator Olson has moved that Senate Bill 324 be reported out without recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Finance and Revenue Committee. Is there a discussion on this motion?
The reason I made this motion, Mr. Chair, is this process is expedited, moving along too quickly. It's not transparent. It's apparent that it's not transparent. And I feel that with more time and more work, we can make a bill that will work. And that's why I moved to move it to revenue, as it is a hidden gas tax.
Okay. Well, I appreciate your sentiments. I disagree. We've been working on this since 2009. It's time to, in my opinion, lift the sunset. I won't be supporting the motion, but certainly respect your right to bring it. So is there any further discussion on the motion? Seeing none, could you call the roll?
Senator Devereaux?
No.
Senator Pozanski?
No.
Senator Thompson?
Yes.
Vice Chair Olson?
Yes.
Chair votes no.
Motion
fails. Motion fails.
Mr. Chair, I would like to give notice of a minority report.
We haven't done anything.
Well, we haven't, but this is just the amendment.
I'm still going to give you notice.
Okay. You can do it again.
I'll tell you what, it's coming.
It's coming. So we have the bill, Senate Bill 324, as...
That's right, I guess.
As,
two no's.
Amended by the Dash 6 amendments.
Mr. Chair, move the bill, which is Senate Bill 324, as amended by the Dash 6, to the floor of the due pass recommendation. Thank you.
Senator Prozonsky has moved Senate Bill 324 to the floor as amended by the Dash 6 amendments. Is there discussion?
Mr. Chair, no.
Go ahead.
Senator Thompson.
So this is our last chance to...
This is it.
Okay. I just want to make a couple of comments. Thank you.
Please.
It's been an interesting process. I learned a lot. Being I took the last session off the Environment Committee, got a little bit more involved this time. What I kind of see in this whole thing is, you know, if you look, kind of like what Senator Olson said earlier, if you look at what Oregon doesn't do very well, we're last, almost last in graduation rates. Our per capita income is below average. We're not very good at those things, but we're somewhere around, so I don't get liar pants on fire, somewhere around top five in the country in low carbon emissions. So I think we do that pretty well here. We've done really good with the low fuel, the mixtures we're using. I think we have done this on a market-driven way. This, to me, this type of legislation is social engineering. I think we ought to let markets do this themselves. The carbon numbers that we have today are what pretty close to what California is trying to get in 10 years. So we're way ahead of the rest of the country in these issues. I think if you look at what is going to happen this session, this is one little thing. I got put on the transportation task force with you. I feel there is a need to put additional investments in our roads, bridges. We have to maintain those with our income. Our revenue from gas tax has gone down as our mileage per vehicle has gone up. So we're looking at new ways to do that. And I think we're also going to have, they're looking at raising the minimum wage. They're looking at paid sick leave. We've got policies in here that are going to increase insurance costs. And if we're going to be asked to support a transportation tax to maintain our roads and bridges, and then we have this. So this is just one more thing that I think it's just bad timing. I think we're already fifth in the nation in carbon emissions. We do a pretty darn good job of that. And I think if when people will say, well, this is just one bill, but no, this is one bill in the session that's going to lead to a lot of increased cost to business, which are going to hurt our working Oregonians. And this, to me, is another is a hidden gas tax that won't the dollars from this or will not go to benefit and help us maintain our roads and infrastructure. I think that's what we need to concentrate on. If this bill passes, I see little hope of a transportation package passing later in the session. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Przanski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I believe, looking at the members here, I'm the only member that was here in 2009 on this committee. And I'll tell you, to me, this is the next steps. We've had a commission that was actually selected with a very large cross-section of individuals and organizations and businesses, including one of the largest employers in Douglas County, which is in the wood fiber wood industry. And they all have come out unanimously in support of us moving forward and taking the next steps. We need to do our part, and our part is taking this vote and moving forward to allow for these opportunities with the Clean Fuels Program to give Oregonians the opportunity to see and increase opportunities in the economy and in cleaning the environment and doing our fair share. And knowing what's happening around us, this is an appropriate step for us to take. We have enough exits, relief valves, that we can, in fact, if this seems that we need to adjust, we can adjust. We'll be back next year. We'll be back every year, in fact, for the legislature to take any other actions that are necessary. But at this point, based on the information I've heard and the impact of over a 10-year period of potentially of 1 to 2 cents a gallon difference, I'm ready to move forward. And I appreciate all of the time this commission of these individuals and organizations that have come together and done a much greater input and research than we could ever do. And I think it's time for us to follow their lead and vote affirmatively. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Przanski.
Senator
Dember.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I voted for this bill in 2009, and I did primarily because I was concerned with reducing our carbon footprint and doing what we could in that direction. I'm like Senator Beyer, who led off the discussion of this bill. I'm a father. I'm a grandfather. I'm looking down the road. I'm committed to seeing us do what we can as a state to lower the impact of global warming. I have to admit that I really didn't understand the program very well. And although we did have a hearing or two on it, I think when I was in the House on the Energy and Environment Committee, I was not the chair of that committee. And, you know, it's different when you're not the chair in terms of how the sense of responsibility that you feel about understanding a program. But when I found myself last year inheriting the chairship of this committee, I felt like I really had to delve into this and come to understand it. And as many of you know, over the course of last year, we had a couple of hearings on this subject to get the most recent understanding, not only of how the rules were being developed for it, but also the national conversation around clean fuels. You know, and we saw that, you know, some of the initial fears about this program, which were based on its initial conception as really being about corn-based ethanol and blending, you know, we have seen how the program has really developed into a full array of alternative fuel stocks. And so some of those initial projections, which, you know, the sort of scary numbers that we're hearing about potential increase are based on that. You know, the study that was done by the Boston Consulting Group has been pretty much discredited by peer-based analysis coming from a number of sources. That has changed. We've seen that, you know, the program in British Columbia has been going on for a number of years now, and those ill effects have not developed. We see the California program. We're coming to understand it better. Another thing that I hadn't fully appreciated was the sort of economic development component of this. And that was really brought home to me when I visited the Port of Morrow, which I've referenced already. You know, I visited the Port of Morrow with Senator Hansel last May and saw firsthand just the explosion of growth that's happening there. I do believe that there is tremendous potential for economic development here in Oregon. I just want to conclude my remarks by quoting testimony that came from my computer died.
Timed out.
It was timed out. All right, so
too
let me.
Long-winded.
Yeah, so I'll just say, I'll summarize. No, I didn't.
What you just said.
I thought that this hearing was going to end 15 minutes ago.
I did too, Senator.
Yeah. So, but let me just say that the testimony that we got from the Oregon Wheat Growers League, which they are, you know, among that long group of businesses or entities that support this, they talked specifically about the sort of miraculous developments that are happening in the Morrow-Umatilla area because of this new industry. And they talk about the huge potential of it for particularly rural economic development. I mean, we've been hearing about the impact of this based on some really speculative numbers about the, you know, the increase in the cost of fuel. You know, the Oregon Wheat Growers League, which, you know, I believe that they represent people in the rural areas, they were very, very strong in the statement that this had the potential to really grow the rural economy even further than it does now. And, you know, I think that the program has, there have been a number of objections raised in many, many meetings, as we've heard, but we've seen the program develop and change in order to address those. To say that participation on a committee has been just window dressing and that there has not been a listening to of the concerns, that I think doesn't really hold water, because we have seen all of these additions to the Clean Fuels Program that makes me very comfortable with it, and I enthusiastically will support it.
Senator Olson, any other remarks?
Absolutely. Thank you very much.
You bet.
This is an important issue for Oregon. It's an issue that will define us for the future. We are a small market, very, very small compared to the rest of the world. This market defines us not only in our carbon output, and we talk carbon, it's not carbon, it's CO2. Let's remember that. It's CO, it's what we breathe out every day. It's what trees suck in every day to grow. It's CO2, it's not carbon. The point is that it defines our economy. It puts us in a threshold where we have states to the east of us that don't have these additional costs that we will have to deal with. It makes us not economically advantageous to move ahead with programs because our costs are so much more expensive than other states. Washington hasn't done this yet. Washington's looking at it. We look at a series, as Senator Thompson mentioned, a series of bills that impacts our energy. The importance of a class I took last summer when we talked about coal and we talked about different methods of fuels and different fuels we have available. There's a bill in this building right now that says we're not going to use coal for electrical generation. But we talk about electricity like it's an everyday thing because we can go plug our car in. We have renewables. Renewables are extraordinary, except they're not baseload renewables. We can't count on them day in and day out. But what can we count on? What we can count on in our state is our ability to move and be transported to where we need to get, whether it be to work, transport goods throughout our state, or just to go to the beach to visit. This is going to be a cost impact on Oregonians. It's going to cost us money. And as it costs us more money, it raises our cost of living beyond what we have to the north and south of us. California can do what they want. They're a huge market. And we talk all the time about California's market and how wonderful their program is. But as we all know, it's been laying idle for the last 4 years because of litigation. As Senator Thompson mentioned, their goal is 89.25. We're already at 89.31, and we propose to put in millions and millions and millions of dollars to lower carbon content that already beats California's by a long shot. California won't get close for 10 years. We want to be a leader. We are a leader. Senator Thompson, everybody's talked about the fact that we do really well in air quality, in water quality. As a matter of fact, ironically enough, 111D, EPA 111D rules wants us to reduce our air quality by 48%, although we're one of the best states in the nation, whether it be 1, 3, or 5. So this bill came about in 2009 and wasn't able to move forward. And it wasn't able to move forward because there was a bipartisan consensus that it was not a good bill. Bipartisan consensus. It started in 2009, and let's look at the similarity. There was a supermajority by one party. When the balance came back into effect, parties got together and said, this is not a good bill to move forward. We should not extend the sunset. Here we are back again. Now we have a supermajority, and suddenly it's a good bill to move forward with unclear science, with really not any clear projection as what it's going to cost Oregonians, because it will cost us. We have a history in Oregon of getting into projects that we say will work and don't, and cost Oregonians billions of dollars. I'm all for taking care of the environment, but let's make certain that the science actually says what it's going to do. What is reality? This is reality. The red chart shows the fuels that we will not be able to use. This is reality. And yes, there are fuels of the future. There's no question about it. But let's be clear about this bill. This is social engineering.
We want you off the highways. We want you into public transportation. We don't want to pay more for roads, and we want you to buy different cars to make our air cleaner. It's going to cost Oregonians dearly. It's going to put us at an economic disadvantage. And when we have industry contractors that have to go to work and pay more for fuel, it can do nothing but drive up the cost for everyone, for fuel, for food, for our gas, and for our lives. And that's why I'm opposed to this bill, because we do not have the science to back it up.
Thank you, Senator Olson. I will be supporting the bill, and I'll echo some of the comments of some of my colleagues, and not the comments of others.
Are you leaving mine out?
Surprise, surprise. So as chair of the committee, I felt a very strong responsibility to make sure that the issues were well vetted. And I have spent an ungodly amount of hours in the last 3 weeks going through different aspects of this bill. And that's why when the bill was first brought to me, I signed on as a co-sponsor. I wanted to push this conversation, but I didn't want to chief sponsor it until today, because I've become convinced through this process that we've had that those questions have been answered. And while there will always be speculation about what exactly Oregon will look like in 5 years, 10 years after the implementation of this program, for many of us, there's not a whole lot of speculation about what's happening to our planet. And what the West Coast of the United States does matters, in not just in the U.S., but in the world. We are the fifth largest economy in the world, and the world is looking at us. I know folks overseas that I've spoken with investment bankers in Asia. When I was speaking with them, we were talking about U.S. politics just generally. I was floored by how much they knew about the U.S. Senate. Every single race, they knew way more than I knew about what was happening at the federal level. And I asked them, I said, I can't believe how much you guys know about what's going on in the U.S. And they said, man, what you guys do matters. We all pay attention to what the U.S. does. And from British Columbia through the tip of California is the fifth largest economy in the world. So what we do actually matters. I'm enthused about the potential for job creation. I know that we're spending millions and millions and millions of dollars on oil to fuel our cars that is going out of the state. I know that. I know that we could do better on the carbon intensity of our fuels, but we've got to break the stranglehold on the system. But I don't think that the members of this committee are well enough informed. We don't meet enough. You know, we're not well enough equipped to proscribe exactly how that ought to go in a command and control system, which is why I like this credit system. It offers flexibility. It offers choice. And I think a lot of those choices are going to benefit consumers. And I know that a lot of those choices are going to be homegrown, and it's going to be money invested in jobs, probably in each of our districts. So to me, this is a win-win. It matters on many, many different levels. And I'm proud to support the bill and the effort. So with that.
Call a question.
But if you don't mind, well, I guess I can't start. Would you be willing to withdraw? Because I was just going to call for a vote.
Well, the call's the question.
You did call the question. See, I'm still, yeah. We called the question. Do I have to?
I think technically you're supposed to vote on the call to the question.
Well, yeah, that's why I didn't want to. That's why
I'll remove my call.
Okay. So would you please call the roll? Yeah.
Senator Dumbro.
Aye.
Aye. Senator Thompson.
Nope.
Vice Chair Olson.
No.
Chair Edwards.
Chair votes yes.
Mr. Chair, I make notice of a minority report.
the bill passes. We have
hearing.
Notice of minority report. Senator Beyer is going to be carrying the bill.
Mr. Chair, before we close.
Yes.
I would like to commend you on the way you handled the testimony and allowed everyone to speak their piece. I give you great applause for that.
Me too.
I appreciate that, and I appreciate your vigorous questioning. And no, I'm serious, you know, and I thank all the opponents. So we're going to close the work session on Senate Bill 324, and the committee is adjourned.
Good.
And the committee is adjourned.
Good.
24.